It's episode 19 of Chefs on the Pass, the Craft Guild of Chefs official podcast. Let's go! And today I'm joined by the brilliant Hayden Groves, former National Chef of the Year, consultant, cyclist, author, and all-round powerhouse of energy and stories. We chat about his journey from selling lemon drizzle cake in the school playground to leading the kitchens at Lloyd's of London and Barclays. He shares how cycling shaped his mindset, the wild intensity of the corporate dining world, and of course we dive into the famous grouse incident. The moment that nearly broke him, but ultimately set him up for his biggest career win. Hayden is a force of nature, full of humility and humour, so make sure you hit that subscribe button and come right on in. And a massive welcome to the show, Hayden Groves. How are you doing?
Hi, Phil. Yeah, very well, thank you. Yourself?
Yeah, very good indeed. Feeling excited to have this chat to you today, because I think what I really... This is kind of why I love doing podcasts. You know, you and I haven't really had any connection in the past, but in the last month or so, we had Kira, just won the Young National Chef of the Year, on the show, and you reached out on the back of that saying you might have an interesting story to tell. And we had a little chat, and I agree with you. It sounds really interesting.
Well, I don't know about that. Interesting to some, shall we say. Yeah, interesting to some.
Well, let's put that to the test then, shall we? Just tell the world what it is that you actually do right now.
So I am a freelance chef and consultant now. After that pandemic that we all lived through, can we believe that?
I know.
Yeah, it's like a movie. Many, I was made redundant from a nice job. It sort of forced my hand pretty much. And I set up as a one-man band, set up as a consultant, trading under a name. And here we are.
Yeah. Haven't looked back.
Five years later, we're still going. Net, all is good.
Good stuff. Well, we'll talk about a bit more about that in the fullness of your journey. I'd love to take you all the way back to the beginning to really understand what brought you into this industry in the first place.
Well, when I was at school, wasn't very academic, probably like most chefs. And I could knock up an amazing lemon sponge, you know, sell it in the school playground.
Contraband.
Contraband now, but you know, 20 pence a slice for a lemon drizzle cake is very good value.
It's
very popular. More stocks last. Yeah, luckily we don't have the allergen law that we do now, because in the calories, you know what I mean, I'd have never got past the baking process. But
there's bound to be three lines of teacher gates that you have to get through before you do anything like that, probably these days.
Yeah. Well, back then in the 80s, it was a lot easier, shall we say.
Yeah.
But my dream was to be a pro cyclist as a 15, 16-year-old. And that was my passion. But failing sort of having an entry into that sort of world, I went to college, studied Sitting Guild 7061, 7062, did the usual sort of college circuit, 2 years, had a part-time job. I had several part-time jobs. My first part-time job, 15 and three quarters. I got my NIA number, so it allowed me to work, and I got a job at local McDonald's. 12 weeks, two shifts. So what was that, 24 shifts. Got my three stars, but not, unfortunately, not Michelin. But it's a stepping stone. And that was during the sort of school holidays. Went to college, then I got a job at a local sort of hotel restaurant, doing starters, helping the chef, wiping down, helping with the desserts, the weddings kind of thing. I did my 2 years of college, sort of exited that. I was still sort of racing. I was racing as a road cyclist, so I was sort of doing both.
So you did kind of start on the path then. You were still focused on this is a dream, this is something I would like to achieve. So you did walk the path, well, cycle the path, I guess.
I cycled the path, yeah, but back in the late 80s, cycling wasn't the mainstream sport that it is now. I mean, in the UK, it's a bit like the new golf for a lot of people, you know. They were running, then they worked out it's quite hard on the knees, and then they start buying very expensive bikes and dress up in lycra and go out on Sundays and go and drink coffee.
Don't even get me started.
but back in those days, the sport was very different. But I competed in my 16s, teens, right up to my sort of early 20s. I was riding, but it was quite hard. It was quite hard to sort of compete and cook and sort of be on your feet for sort of 50, 60 hours a week running around and sort of do and be competitive, shall we say, at the weekend on the racing. But I sort of did both, and I did the circuit of sort of local restaurants and hotels, and then I went into London, and I went in the BNI side of business. so business and industry.
Yeah, yeah, yeah. So straight away, more or less, in your career. You got in there quite early.
Yeah, pretty much in my early 20s. Because what it allowed me to do then is it allowed me, no matter how hard I worked during the week, it afforded me the opportunity to sort of turn up on the start line along with 60 to 100 other guys and sort of go and smash yourself for 60 miles, 100 miles, whatever the race was. Yeah. I got up to sort of national level. I raced pre-national championships. Claim to fame was I got off at the same time on the finishing circuit as Chris Boardman. I mean, that was the level that I was racing at.
Right.
You know, we all know that he was quite talented, and here I was on the Monday running about in a kitchen the next day. So I sort of realised that I was never really going to achieve what I needed to cycling wise. So focus was sort of the chefing,
yep.
But it allowed me to still sort of live out a bit of a passion. I sort of fast forward a little bit into my mid-20s, and suddenly I find myself in charge of 25 people. So the sort of career step sort of went up. It's done it all, really, from a manufacturing site 24/7, just sort of a role that wasn't really my passion. It was far from where ingredients go to die, but it was sort of 24/7, sort of five services a day. And there's some things that you sort of learn, that there's some takeaways and some skills and some hacks that I still remember now that are bloody handy, especially when you're doing large volumes. But it wasn't really what I wanted to do. I like the finer things. I like cooking at a sort of a fairly decent level and sort of the mass catering side of things. That wasn't really my passion. And again, it was means to an end. It allowed me to be competitive on the bike.
Yeah. Plus, I suppose there's also this element of, I mean, you've got to try something, right? You don't know really until you're in it whether it is going to be the thing that will ignite you or not. Mm. And that's okay. As well, you know, as part of a journey somewhere, you've got to, a lot of it is about figuring out as much the stuff that you don't want to do as the stuff that you do.
Yeah. I then worked for a very large pharmaceutical company in Hertfordshire, in Stevenage, GlaxoSmithKline. I had 20 chefs there. Majority of everything was made from scratch. So it was a really good B&I site spread over a big campus. You know, there was a lot of what we did, a lot of homemade cakes, pastries, you know, and it was everything from, should we say, baked beans on toast, jacket potato with cottage cheese, to sort of visitors dining en masse. So, you know, there was a lot of skill set there, and it allowed you to sort of dip your toe into sort of compliance, health and safety. You went down the route of obviously all of the appraisal side of things. So it was really preparing you for later in life. Mm. So two and a half years of that was a big stepping stone and a learning curve for me. I still rode. And then came my biggest career opportunity, Lloyd's of London. So I was 29 when I got offered the job. I was 30 when I started as exec chef at the very famous building in the centre of the city with the lifts on the outside.
Right.
I think probably the youngest exec chef in a 300 odd year history of the building.
Wow. Yeah. Mm-hmm. And I love stuff like this because there's I'd imagine that the sport played a massive part in your own self-confidence as well in terms of your ability, but also I'm guessing, by the way, I don't know for sure, but yeah, we'll obviously talk about
it. I don't think it gets you much confidence just to sort of creep over the line and finish 18th in the points, but I understand what you mean. Yeah. Yeah.
But
I think it dovetailed into the discipline side of cooking. If you didn't train, you couldn't be competitive. If you didn't do your mise en place, you weren't going to deliver a service. If you couldn't draft or use other people around you, you'd never get in the break. If you didn't learn to use those people around you, you'd never be able to do service because you can't do that on your own. So there was a lot of similarities between the discipline of being competitive and being sporty, as there was in your, you know, but both sort of dovetailed into each until I got to Lloyd's of London, where, you know, it was the heart of the financial boom. It was 2004. It was super busy. I never put a number on my back again in a competitive situation.
Is that right? That was it. Right. It was literally, this is my career now.
Yeah, cycling as a sport, as in being competitive, ended when I took the job. Yeah.
Right. Yeah. But I also, I mean, I'm just a massive advocate for exercise anyway. It brings so much to your life, just in terms of, and especially in a busy job as well. And yes, I can understand that, you know, you're in a busy job and you're training at a pretty high standard, that you're putting yourself through your paces for sure. But there's the science side of why exercise is good for you as well. And I would imagine that actually by training to some degree, that's just good for you in terms of keeping your energy high and keeping your ability to actually operate at a high level. You've got a way more chance of doing it.
Yeah, yeah. I mean, and I think the benefit and the pressure of Lloyd's of London was, whether you did 90 hours a week, no matter what came from Monday to Friday, you had the weekend off. So if I left the house before 6 and got in after midnight 3 days a week, and it didn't see a young family, come Saturday morning, you would see them. So there was, you could plan. And also it afforded the opportunity then to sort of, even in the winter, sort of just go out, get some fresh air on the bike, sort of come back, spend the time on the family. So cycling then became, for me, more of a release, more of just go and get some headspace, just sort of compartmentalize what happened during the week, even think about what's happening during the week coming. You know, think of some situations that went well or went bad, or what you've got coming up. You know, it was just a sort of more sort of fresh air, really.
Yeah.
Stretching the legs rather than any form of training.
Yeah, yeah. And how did you manage that step up into that exec chef at such a, you know, as you say, it's a really high profile site. A lot of eyes on it, probably internally as well, in terms of, you know, what you're able to do from a consistency perspective day to day. What's that feeling like when you make a step up into something like that?
It was huge pressure. I mean, I took the job, and between taking the job and actually starting, several members of staff had sort of left or were leaving, or there was a huge churn back then. And August I started, and, you know, like always in the summer, it's fairly quiet in the city. A lot of people took their holidays, but come September, it was a bump. It was busy. October, we had events coming all over the place, you felt the pressure, but I wanted it, and I wanted it badly, and I wanted to succeed, and I wanted to prove those that either felt that I could do the job, or the doubters and naysayers that felt I couldn't, right or wrong at the same time. I mean, I give you an idea. One morning, I was sort of literally running from Liverpool Street down the steps from the first train. So we're talking about 6:05 in the morning here, down Bishopsgate, tripped, sort of twisted my ankle, got to work, double espresso, couple of ibuprofen. It wasn't until, this was, I think it was a Wednesday, it wasn't until the following Monday that it turns out that I'd broken my foot.
Blimey.
That's what, I always joke, that's what it took at the time. That's what it took at the time. That winter 2004, I remember, we had an event for 175 that evening after BAU. So we had a sit-down event, a dinner, and I remember prepping with a 15-litre sort of stainless steel bucket under one foot, the bad one. And I'd done the classic David Beckham injury. One of the lads, it was just before Christmas, one of my sous chefs said to me, "Chef, why don't you just sort of go up and have a scan done on that?" You know what I mean? We you know, it was a couple of days before Christmas. I even remember missing the bus to the sort of hospital, and I remember half sort of jogging, half hobbling to get to the hospital, thinking, you know, this is a waste of time. And I got there, and they said, "You broke your foot," but there wasn't much you could do, really. It was one of those metatarsally kind of things.
A metatarsally situation.
Yeah, one of those bad boys. And over Christmas, the swelling has subsided after. But yeah, it was on. But the I hate to say whether accident prone or not, but fast forward, I think it was a year or year and a half later, I ended up having an accident on my bike. I actually found out several years later that I tore my ACL in my knee, and somehow, don't ask me how, I managed to get into work the next day, pedaling one foot to the train station, hobbling along. I mean, naturally, I couldn't straighten or bend the knee. Same hospital. This time, I took the bus. And all they were interested in was my thumb. They weren't concerned about the knee. It wasn't until, I think it was about 8 or 9 years later, when I signed up to do a crazy cycling challenge. I had an MRI on it, and the specialist said, "You had an accident." And I said, oh, yeah, many years ago. He said, you tore your ACL. Yeah. If you're a footballer, you'd have been out for six months. You know?
Yeah. And yet you kind of cracked. I just got on with life for 8 or 9 years.
Yeah, just get on. I mean, I didn't. A badge of honour was I haven't had a day off this millennium, like, you know, where I hadn't been sick. I turned up every single day at Lloyd's of London.
Right.
Apart from holidays, obviously.
Yeah. Well, yeah. Yeah. And it's its own story, though, isn't it, as well, in terms of, like, you know, my brain is going through so much right now trying to kind of process this around, you know, there's, on the one hand, like, everybody talks about the sacrifice you need to make when, if you want to be, you know, if you want to experience anything that looks like, well, I suppose, you know, great success. Everybody talks about there's some kind of sacrifice that comes with that, whether that is time lost with family, whether, you know, whatever it might look like. It's individual for each story. But then there's also the flip side of this. You're sacrificing your potential long-term health here for...
Let's not focus too much on that because I'm sitting here with a gap in my tooth, which is another story.
But, you're just a war-torn individual.
War-torn, yeah. The tails deep in the trenches from the groves. But... it was. I think I wanted it so badly that the pain was easy to park.
Right.
I worked with many colleagues that it was like, right, keep up if you can, sort of thing. And many of my industry peers would have said back in those days that I was probably under the influence of something. But trust me, hand on heart and on my girls, that it's the only thing I was under the influence was pure adrenaline. And, you know, if I wasn't riding a bike, I was getting the adrenaline from some working hard or an event or how on earth are we going to deliver this today? Well, let's just push on. You know what I mean?
Yeah.
Let's lead by example. Yeah.
This is such a subject matter. I think it is up for it's constantly in debate. And this for me has its roots in the same problem as most of the problems that we have in today's society, which is that you've either got to be one thing or another. And in actual fact, you know, everybody is completely different. I've spoken to so many people around the fact, you know, the work-life balance is a major focus right now, quite rightly. I mean, I have a thing, it's actually for me, we can lose work-life and just look at balance. That's the only word that really matters. But balance for everybody is so different. So, you know, there's no right or wrong here with this. For some people, they want to, you know, and you're probably a case in point here by the sounds of your own journey, is that I'll go and work 80 hours a day because that, a day? God, I'm not sure I could even do that myself. Because, you know, I'll go and work 80 hours a week because I just love what I do and it gives me the thing that I need and all of that at the same time as, you know, somebody else who could look at you and go, God, I couldn't do that. I just couldn't do that. And that's also fine.
Yeah, absolutely. And I think probably I look back and, you know, in what are we? So 20 years, I'd look back 20 years ago and think now, yes, it was a bit silly. Didn't have to. Was I thought anything more of? Probably not. Was I taken advantage of? Certainly not. But it was a badge of honour back in those days. You know, those guys are pushing themselves and I created a team around me in a similar style. You know what I mean?
Yeah.
And I was very proud of the team that I worked with and I helped shape over those years.
Yeah. Plus, you know, at the end of the day, sometimes you have just got to crack on, right? I mean,
no one else is going to do it.
Yeah.
You've got, you know, and this is what I say to some people. If two people don't turn up, if your oven is broken, if your fruit and veg delivery doesn't turn up, yes, you can plan for the worst, but you can't plan for everything. The show must go on, you know?
Yeah.
The show, you've got to find a way. And I think that was my ability back then was always strategically thinking, if this goes wrong, or if that goes tits up, or if our double boiler doesn't work, or if our oven's gone down, or I'm a chef down, how can we make it happen? And it was always plan for the worst and hope for the best sort of approach.
Yep.
But luckily, we made it happen, including, you know, in my tenure back in 2005, we had the Queen visit, so... It was an amazing, amazing time and opportunity during my tenure there, which was just over 8 years. I got to cook for the majority of our national royalty and some international royalty at the same time. So,
yeah. I mean, and that's, you know, you probably, you don't take the job for that reason, right?
It's
just a happy accident that comes along as an opportunity.
Yeah, no one says, look, I'll take the job because, in our black book and our crystal ball in the future, it's X, Y, and Z. I knew it was an amazing place, and I knew it came with its health and safety challenges. I mean, the kitchen won an award in 1986, but when I took the job in 2004, there was some challenges with it. So part of my job wasn't just the cooking. It was the health and safety stuff and everything that I'd learned from my GSK time to bring Lloyd's of London up to what I would call up to scratch. And, you know, when I left, we had a beautiful menu systems induction suite there, moved away from some gas cooking and saved a lot of money on energy through extraction and all of that, and learned about BTUs, and I learned about, you know, lux meter readings, and I learned all of that European slip test. So, my job was to exit Lloyd's in a better place than where I took over. Yeah,
brilliant. Yeah, well, I mean, 8 years. It's quite a significant chunk of time.
It is, and I think, you know, it was one of those jobs. If you weren't 30 and you were 40, you'd have probably, you know, you'd have been there as long as until they kicked you out. You know what I mean? But I was still hungry and just sort of what was the next stage, and I'd taken it as far as I could. Really, we had four kitchens. You know, it was you felt you had another big move in you. You know what I mean? So I was just before I, 38-ish, before your 40th birthday, you felt that you'd learnt enough in that role, but you were still young enough to be sort of, should we say, desirable quantity to someone. Or that's the way I position myself. And actually, I wasn't looking. Someone came looking for me. So
that's often the way, isn't it? Often the way. And especially, I suppose, when you're at that length of service, again, there's no right or wrong way to do anything when you're talking about someone's journey. With my recruitment hat on, we were always taught when in my younger years as a recruiter, you know, that when somebody has been there that length of time, that they've reached a level of comfort that's very difficult to then, you know, take them out and put them into somewhere else. I, as an older guy, I completely disagree with that statement. You know, there's a reason why somebody stays as long as they do. And a lot of the time that is because, you know, you've got a job to do and you don't feel that it's finished, or, you know, there's always something new to be done or implemented.
The job is, like you say, the job is never finished, really. There's always someone else to cook for. There's always a new menu. There's always new dishes. There's always a new member of staff, a new sous chef to train, or whatever it is. There's always a why. And what was quite strange for me is I'd sort of built up a lot of sort of longevity in the role. And naturally, I had to give sort of a sizable amount of notice period. And here I was representing the company at the Parade de Chef. And my last sort of official business was leading the team in the Parade de Chef as team captain. And we won very proudly. We left on a high because we won a gold and best in show that week.
Right.
And here I was on stage with that team at that stage with the CEO, handing him on stage at the sort of the company awards. 4 o'clock that afternoon, I was no longer an employee. And he sort of pulled me to one side and said, why are you leaving? You don't have to leave, blah, blah, blah. And it's like, well, on the Monday, I was set for a new challenge. And it was like, it was sad to leave. It was proud to leave with your head held high at that point where you couldn't sort of get any better than that, representing the business with a team, with six other chefs, Parade the Chef, representing the business, winning the gold, team captain, and best in show was a very proud moment, yeah.
Yeah, brilliant, brilliant. So what yearage are we in at this point? What would be?
So that would be 2012, so that would be Olympic year. Then it found me cooking, not in the city, but in Canary Wharf on the 31st floor, looking after Bob Diamond at Marcliffe's. So it was, again, a very different scenario. At Lloyd's, again, it was cooking for anyone from the cleaners to royalty. So there was tins of baked beans, there was jacket potatoes for staff dining, there was beautiful array of homemade cakes, petit fours, ice cream, there was turbot, there was foie gras, there was international royalty and everything in between at Lloyd's London.
Mm.
Here at Barclays, it was faux Michelin star. It was a beautiful restaurant on the 31st floor overlooking Greenwich Park, beautiful JL Coquet plates. It was cooking pretend restaurant environment for the board, the directors and the guests.
Yeah.
With a team of like-minded individuals around you.
You know, you raise another fantastic point around like the standard of cooking within contract environments is rarely given the kudos that it probably deserves in the wider world because nobody really knows about it, right? I've got a book somewhere, might be on this shelf. Yeah, up there, Hidden Chefs it's recipes from people like you in that kind of environment whereby, you know, you're cooking to a standard that not many people get to experience
it's a hidden dining room, Phil, as you say. One of the challenges was they weren't there to eat. Although they were to eat, they were there to entertain, but they were to talk about business.
Yeah.
You know, you're 3 to 5 courses or whatever it was. It was either just acceptable because it helped the deal go down, but it wasn't, the menu wasn't on the front of the, you know, the evening standard, you know, is the hot ticket to go and eat at. It was just, you cooked for the business elite. Yes, every now and then you might get an email from a guest or the PA of the director saying, just so you know, it was delicious. But generally you would only find out if something went wrong or dinner was late. Or
No TripAdvisor reviews to wade yourself through.
There was no TripAdvisor reviews. No one came in because you'd seen you on Great British Menu. It was... Or even though we did feature in Great British Menu, actually we filmed in, I think it was 2011 with Tom Kerridge when I was at Lloyd's in London, which was quite a story, probably one we could touch on, including when we turned all the extraction off and it got a bit hot because it was a bit loud and for the filming, got a bit hot and sticky down there. He said, come on, Chef, can't we turn that extraction off? He was absolutely dripping.
Right. But
the film crew wanted
to be able to hear
the sound of what was,
yeah. It's funny, oh my God, yeah. But you know, the point, another great point, you just keep dropping the gold, why don't you? That you raise is around, you know, actually it doesn't really matter what business you're in. Like you've just highlighted your purpose there as exec chef in that particular environment was whatever the guest needs from you. So it's not you're not in an environment where you're chasing accolades or you can go out and get a star, whatever that looks like to anyone. You're there because you're part of that whole thing is possibly going to help people feel relaxed and comfortable enough to be able to do business well enough to be able to get that deal over the line.
100%. And I realized that at an early age when you cook for the business elite, they could go and eat it in any restaurant that they want. They could probably get that table, you know.
Yeah.
They could get that table if they needed it, even though they're fully booked. But essentially, they might come in for, you know, new season grouse one day, and then somebody else want an egg white omelette with, you know, a green salad and just some cut fruit. And that's what they want. And, you know, the same level of detail will go into that, you know, those two plates.
Yeah.
And if that's what they want, then they can have it. You know what I mean? We're not a dining room where, you know, we don't cook for vegetarians or vegans, or if it's not on the menu, it doesn't feature. Or the answer is yes. What was it you wanted again? Sorry.
Yeah.
That was the approach. You know, and during that time, you know, I dipped my toe into sort of competing again, but under my own name. So I'd been very fortunate that we'd tasted success as a team. And I was team captain for the Parade de Chef, and you know I'd achieved several golds at Hotel Olympia, and I'm very proud of them. But it was never under my own name. So my last year of being at Lloyd's of London, I was going to compete at National Chef of the Year. So it was my first time of writing something meaningful and putting name on a piece of paper and a couple of tasty dishes to the criteria. And then that saw me through the changes of jobs. So then into sort of the Barclays and then into future role where my role took me next.
Yeah.
And that was my opportunity to sort of try and get some accolades industry wise, because you were never going to achieve a Michelin star. You were never going to get AA. I was lucky that I achieved a sort of Craft Guild of Chefs award for being the chef's chef, which was for what you did day to day. And I think that was, 2006, for recognition what I'd done at Lloyd's of London. But it's, you know, it wasn't the same as sort of having an accolade for you, for your cooking or being what you do as a chef for your, you know.
But I do love that. I love that award though, because it's like in football, it's like the player's player award, right?
It's like,
it's recognition amongst those people who really understand what you do day to day.
Yeah. So I was very proud of that to sort of achieve that, and sort of a long list of of previous winners and count my name and certainly so young in a career of senior positions.
Yeah. So that transition from one job to the next took you into the world of National Chef of the Year, as you've highlighted as well. You also mentioned, maybe you did this completely on purpose, but it was a nice segue. You talked about a nice tasty grouse dish.
I did, yeah.
There's a story about grouse, I believe, with regards to your National Chef of the Year journey as well.
Yeah. So my first year of competing, what was that? That must have been 2010. So I'd still been at Lloyd's. I entered the competition. We used to have a semi-final stage then, so it would be down to 40. I was 11th, and the only reason I know I was 11th was 10 went through to the final at a restaurant show, and there was a reserve. I was the reserve.
Right.
So you didn't want any ill to befit the top 10, but you just wished one of them would win a luxury holiday somewhere that they couldn't turn down. So,
that's a wonderfully positive way to put it. Yeah.
It was, yeah. Rather than one of them fall on their own sword. But yeah. It wasn't to be, but I watched that year's final thinking, right, 2011, I'm all in. 2011, I entered, and it was one of those strange quirks of fate that I'd got my place in the semi-final, but actually in London, but actually it was the same time that I was due to be my long-suffering sous chef, Andrew Biggs, that followed me for four positions, worked with me at Lloyd's of London, and I was due to be his best man in Italy, and they will get married overseas. So it was like, oh God, I can't just go and do a cooking competition. Here I am. I'm privileged to be asked. This guy sort of worked his ass off for me for years.
Yeah.
So I sort of declined sort of my place. And they said, well, what about if we sort of move things around, and could you do Sheffield sort of the week before, you know, if we can sort of, you know, there are 40 people here. So it was like, yeah, okay. You know, I really wanted to compete. I got up there. The winner and runner-up of my heat the previous year were also in that heat. And it was one of those ones where you think, oh, blimey, it's a long way up to from you know, Hertfordshire to Sheffield. I cooked. It went okay. It's never as good as you practice, naturally. They called out the results with the winner and the runner-up going through. There's four semifinals. And they called out the winner of the previous year's heat was the semifinalist runner-up. And I thought, oh, bugger, wasn't my year again. Mm. And they called me out as the winner of the semi-final heat. And my goodness me, it felt like I'd won the whole competition just to sort of make the final.
Yeah.
I was like made up, and it was such a long journey back from Sheffield. It was pouring with rain, but didn't matter. I was on such a high to sort of make that final. 2 days later, Tracy and I are on the plane we didn't make the plane. To fly out to sort of the Amalfi Coast for the wedding because there was a strike in Italy. So we ended up having to fly somewhere else. Then we had to fly into Rome. Then we had to get a coach from Rome. But even then, I still had this big smile on my face, no matter what, that I made the final. Mm. I even joked in my, we got there just in time, but I even joked in my best man speech. I'd even swam across the Bay of Naples to be there because I was like, you know what I mean? I was on a high. The final went okay. Sort of the starter was tasty. The main course was a bit of a car crash. Oven went out. Wasn't the best, but I'm not making excuses. I wasn't sort of going to really make my name that year. Dessert was great, and I still have Graham Hornigold sort of mention the dessert. And I finished third. So I was really, really proud. I'd sort of ticked her. I'd got on the podium. Freddie Foster won that year. Alan Williams was second. These boys had all worked for Ramsay. Yeah. Here I was, started off in McDonald's, cooking. I was at Lloyd's in London, but cooking and B&I, I'd sort of exceeded expectations, mine and probably where everyone thought I would go. That weekend I was riding, thinking out on my bike, look, starter was as I practiced. The main course wasn't great. Dessert apparently was the difference between me getting third place. It was the sort of the best dessert of the day, I had been told. So it made me think, well, if the main course hadn't been so bad, could I have achieved?
Yeah.
So next year, 2012, really went in there with Olympic high hopes. I felt my dishes were better. The mystery basket had game. I thought, right, I'm going to go grouse, going to go all in, going to cook that old bird. You know, it was not old bird, obviously, because it was a young bird. It was new season grouse.
Yeah, that's a brave choice as well. A brave choice for a competition.
Yeah, and I practiced with the same butcher that was delivering on the day. Back then, you cooked for four covers, for three courses from scratch, 2 hours, water out the tap, all your ingredients were there. It was cooking at the restaurant show on stage in front of a live audience. Wow. Very different sort of to what it is now.
Yeah.
The grouse that I had, again, this is where I didn't recalibrate. The grouse I had wasn't the same as what I practiced with. It was certainly a lot smaller. I hadn't readjusted my cooking times to sort of recalibrate. I overcooked the grouse. Difference probably between fourth and second. And then for the ultimate insult, I won £500 for the best presentation award. That really was a slap in the face because in my head, your dishes look good, but tasted shit. That's all I can think about, even to this day, 2012.
Still triggers you. I'm sorry to have brought it up.
It's a trigger. It's a real trigger for someone that really prided themselves on all the gnarly bits from the pan. How can we make it delicious? What can we do? But it was almost like single clap. Well done, you. Yeah, it looked nice, great, but didn't deliver. That was in my head. That was the unofficial fourth place that maybe I didn't get fourth. But, you know, a couple of judges said that the difference between fourth and second was a couple of points and the grouse cost me. Didn't I know it? So, sparked off.
All the while, I mean, look, one of your first dreams was to become a professional cyclist, right? That's quite a competitive environment, I would imagine.
Yeah. I crashed in the rollout.
Yeah, indeed. But also, I'm guessing there's part of your psyche that's like, you know, I still haven't given the best of myself in this competition.
Yeah.
I know that there are things that I could have done well. And if there's a competitive streak within you, like if you'd have left it all out there and there was nothing else you could have, you know, done to make it better and you finished fourth, zero shame in that, right?
Yeah.
You've been beaten by people who were better than you.
Absolutely.
And you accept that and that's all great. But when you know that there is something that you could have done better, I'd imagine there's a deep part of your psyche that went, I can't let this drop.
It hurt a lot, and I was only to blame. You know, you couldn't blame the equipment.
Yeah.
Yes, okay, the grouse was smaller, but that's cooking. I didn't adjust on the day. It took me a couple of days of sort of real deep sort of soul searching. I was a bit really down on myself, but that's competitions. Competition cooking. You put yourself in that arena to be judged.
Yeah, and it's intense, right? It's intense as well.
Yeah, it's 2 hours. 2 hours of your life. I came up short. I failed at English at school. We both mentioned that earlier. That's why I became a chef. That's because of the lemon drizzle cake, you know, 20 pence in the school playground, whatever. But I, for some reason, I created a blog. It had to be cathartic. And for some reason, I just ended up typing. It needed a lot of editing. Don't get me wrong. Tracy helped with the editing, certainly. There was a few there's that were in the wrong place, shall we say. Luckily, I've sort of learned a little bit since. And the blog, it's not about the grouse. It was a sort of a nod to a cyclist that wrote a book called It's Not About the Bike, and obviously a grouse, and sort of merged both together. And here I was, starting blog writing then. The blog got in front of Borough Market, and how about you write a couple of pieces for us? Could you do a couple of recipes? Could you then do a couple of demos for us in the market hall? So out of the sort of thunder cloud comes some silver lining. And
nice.
So without that cathartic blog and without that failure, wouldn't have got me probably front and center for Borough Market and a relationship that I had with Borough Market right up to sort of certainly up to the COVID times when we were doing the demos, the masterclasses and the recipes back in those days.
Yeah.
But the National Chef of the Year journey didn't finish there. Yeah.
Well, indeed. Yeah, yeah. I really love that because that is... That's you effectively just following the energy in which you're in that moment. It's like, I'm just going to do something and it's for me. No expectation of where it goes or what happens. I'm doing it because, as you say, it's cathartic. I need to get something off my chest, which is, you know, bothering me, whatever it is. And then it always astounds me how often when people do the thing that, is, you know, it's almost the path of your own, or the least resistance within your own path. You're just doing something because it feels right. It's the right thing to do for you. Something good comes from that. And I love that. I'm that sounds a bit woo-woo, but I love following energy.
I think there's a quote in the film, Catch Me If You Can. and two mice fall into a bucket of cream. One just drowns and the other tries so hard to get out. It churns that cream to butter and it climbs out. I was probably back then that second mouse that somehow climbed out that bucket of cream.
Right.
Through just want of just pure perseverance, not pig-headedness, because I was not sure of ability. I was anxious. I, you know, even back when I got that third, suffering from a little bit of imposter syndrome, even then, you know, I mean, in third place, wasn't I won. And then, well, we fast forward to 2013. It was fast forward. I mean, we're still well over a decade ago. But I changed jobs again with the same business, with Baxter Story. I was more into project-based role then. So I didn't have a kitchen of my own. I hadn't really cooked in anger for months. It was going round to businesses, going in to see clients. It was helping other brigades. But it wasn't cooking day to day. So here I was entering one final hurrah. It was almost like, shall I do it? Shall I not? Was third the best it could be? Shall I leave that? Not legacy, but shall I leave it like third?
Yeah. Which proud, is still, you know, bloody brilliant, by the way.
Yeah, proud. I mean, let's not forget the £500 of Churchill voucher and the best presentation award. You know, that's certainly in the loft. Sorry, Churchill, but we did spend the £500. Yeah, yeah.
That was the thing that drove you on the most.
That was the thing that absolutely
cannot leave with the presentation award. I've got
I've got
to change that.
And you're probably right. And a good friend of mine said to me, "What do you mean you're not going again? That doesn't sound like you." So we went again, semi final. What I felt, three tasty plates of food, scraped through by my skin and my teeth, just through all the old moves that I still had in me, and I got a place in the final eight. I didn't feel comfortable with it. I didn't feel so. I vowed then never to be in that situation again where I turned up not trained, not ready. I'd had a couple of practices, but it's very different when you sort of don't really have a kitchen of your own to call. Between the semi-final and the final, I was asked then to go into Goldman Sachs to cover for the outgoing chef, Simon Attridge, very talented chef, then went on to go and work at Glen Eagles, and now he's the exec chef, or I think the F&B director at Claridge's. So, you know, some, you know, very big shoes to fill. And he left and there was no one to go in from the business to sort of cover him, steady the ship. So the business said to me, well, it was Noel Marnie at the time, said to me, "Can you go in just 3 months, go in, find a successor, recruit a successor, hand over and then go back onto projects?" So actually it was a godsend. Although Goldman's was a challenge, very demanding client, it also allowed me to cook day to day again. And also allowed me to pick a bloody good commis chef, Peter Lay, to help me for the final. Part of the challenge of going up quite quickly and successfully through the ranks is, at a young age, you never really had mentors. You'd sort of gone through quite quickly into suddenly. And the way I can describe it is you're good at peeling onions. So in other words, when you were a commie, you were given some onions and some shallots and some garlic and you peeled them. And then you progressed. You progressed to sort of trimming some meat and fish, and then you got to the job of actually cooking the meat and the fish, and then you got other people to peel the onions underneath you. But essentially, when you progress and go through the ranks and then become a sous chef and a head chef, no one teaches those skills to you. No one teaches you how to appraise someone or even to use a computer. When I was at school, we didn't have computers.
Yeah.
I didn't know how to use an Excel spreadsheet, how to use word search, and how to use all of the tools that we do now. And when I look back, is all you were good at was working hard, working fast and peeling onions. But you never really had a mentor. You found your own way. For that final, I reached out to Gary Jones at the Manoir and said, "Gary, you've seen me, you know, try hard, but also come up short. The dishes are already wrote. The menu is in, following the criteria. But I'd love it if you could just critique these dishes." I was probably more nervous that day walking along the sort of pebble drive at Le Manoir on a Saturday morning, cool box of ingredients. I did, you know, I just cooked the three dishes, not in sort of the competition rules. you know, that there, that's for colour, isn't it? Yeah, you're probably right. That there needs a bit more acidity. That there is like blah, blah, blah. Dessert's bloody delicious. I wouldn't change anything. And, you know, just need a bit more impact. But that there, that mentorship that Gary sort of really gave me that extra nudge. And then I just refocused on those sort of key points that he'd given me. On that final, I cooked well. Was it my best? It was the best that I could do on that day. You're on the stage, third place goes to, and it went to another chef. And I thought, okay, I've been third before. Didn't want third place. I've got a bronze medal. Second place goes to, and it went to, you know, another fierce competitor, Simon Webb, that's also been on the circuit for years. And I thought, I didn't want second, but I've either won, I've finished nowhere. Then the nerves came.
Right.
Will Torrent called out, and with a menu of mackerel, beef, blackberry and apple, Hayden Groves. And it was just more relief than adulation. I'd realised those final couple of weeks before I cooked in the final, I'd held on so tight. It was like that metaphorically holding that handful of wet sand. I'd held on so tight, I'd squeezed everything through the fingers rather than just bloody cook. Just cook. Just do what you've always done all your career. Use those gnarly bits from the pan. Don't worry about, you know, bits of colour or whimsical herb or whatever it is. Does it deliver on impact? Is it tasty? Is it hot? Is it seasoned? All of those bits. And yes, there were some mistakes that happened in the final. But I think that the final of National Chef of the Year, 2 hours from scratch, four covers, three courses, you're always going to, you know, it's almost who makes the least amount of mistakes. And on that day, it was me.
Yeah.
And it was relief. I was so, so proud. So proud.
I can all imagine.
Apart from the birth of our children, it was the proudest day in my life.
Oh, yeah. Bless you, man. Yeah, yeah. This is something that, not the birth of your children, this doesn't come up on another podcast, but this whole kind of ethos of, like, I don't think I've spoken to anybody yet who has won any competition where there has not been something that hasn't quite gone to plan. And that is just a wonderful reflection of life. Like, you know, of the stuff that happens on your day-to-day in the kitchen. You spoke about it earlier on about, you know, the delivery turns up, it's the wrong size of stuff. It's, you know, whatever it is that happens, the ovens go down, all of that. That just happens. That just happens. And so having something not quite go according to plan in competition is part of competition.
It's just what the hand that you're given in those 2 hours. And that day, you know, the planets aligned. You know, apart from retrospectively being drug tested for Barocca and caffeine, I know no one can say no one can take away that title that very proudly sitting in the office here as I look up at it. Yeah,
nice.
And to have, you know, I was the first person to come from a B&I or food service background in the 40-year history of the competition at that time to sort of win National Chef of the Year, and then to then grace the pages and the front cover of the caterer and hotel keeper, the industry press, a couple of weeks later was another sort of pinch yourself moment. You know, I went into WH Smith's because it was a printed copy back then.
Yeah.
And I took two copies, and I remember going to the to go and pay for it. And the person behind the till took sort of a double check. And I said, yeah, I bought two copies.
Yeah.
You know, one to sort of keep it. So, yeah. She gave it out of respect. She gave me the second copy free.
Oh, bless. There you are.
Obviously, yeah.
Pay it forward. Love it. Love it. Yeah. You're actually the first person that I've spoken to around, you know, who has won it in the past. Not, well, I mean, everybody wins it in the past, right? Whoever I'm speaking to, but who, you know, the people that I've spoken to who have won it very recently. So, you know, we've had Kira and Danny from this year.
Yeah.
And equally last year, we did the same with the winners. But we always talk about the potential impact that has on somebody's career. But with you, we can actually talk about that because, you know, here we are 12 years on from there. And so looking back on that moment, how do you think, if at all, it has impacted your career?
It's a strange anomaly in the sense that the cyclist became a chef and then the chef became a cyclist. So out of the success, and I suppose the column inches and a little bit of notoriety.
Yep.
Because you're a bit of an ambassador between that competition and that date, front page of the Caterer, until next year when Russell Bateman very deservedly won. But those 52 weeks, you're a bit of an ambassador, so you got to bounce a bit.
Yeah.
So I wasn't going to have my restaurant. I wasn't going to have my name above the door. What was I, 2013? I would have been 39. You're at that age where you're thinking, well, you know, starting to ache a little bit when you get out of bed, you know, probably having an ACL deficient knee that you didn't know about.
Oh, well, yeah.
It indeed. Still hadn't been diagnosed at the time. Probably treating yourself, running up and down, and you know, it was gonna catch up with you eventually. I'm no longer Peter Pan. But fast forward to when Russell won in that October, 2014 October, in the autumn, one of my friends saw that Geoff Thomas, ex-England international footballer, was looking for a team to go and ride the Tour de France route one day before the professionals. So here we go. I'm going, right, that's a piece of me. Spoke to Geoff. Geoff mentioned about the fundraising. I almost balked at the sort of the amount of volume of fundraising that we need to do, far more than obviously the tour. The tour was well known. It was 3,500 kilometres of riding, 50,000 metres of vertical over the Pyrenees, the Alps. Yeah. We all knew what that challenge was.
Yeah.
But trying to raise £50,000 through a network, that was going to be the ultimate challenge. So I was like, well, okay, let me check. So first thing first, check with Tracy. What do you think, Tracy? Do you think it's a good idea? Well, you've always wanted to do it. You've always dreamt of sort of like, you know, yeah, I think you should. Next call, I went straight to the top. Didn't go around middle management here. Straight to the top. Dropped a text to Alistair Story, chairman and CEO of WSH. Alistair, you've always been proud of, you know, what I achieved in 2013 and how I kept within the business and was an ambassador for the industry and also for Baxter Story at the time. I didn't sort of just exit or go and sort of chase the dollar, should we say. Yeah. I didn't mention that, far from it, but we both knew that, you know, he's proud of employees. I said to him, I've got this opportunity. First instance, could I sort of take a charity sabbatical and you know, would the business support it? Wholeheartedly, he said yes, but he thought I was crazy and asked me, could I do it? And then said, how can I donate? And made a very generous donation right there, you know, in the form of a charitable check. So I called Geoff back and said, would I take a CAF? If so, my chairman, Alistair Story, A, would like to support, and B, is like to make a donation here and now. And he said, well, you weren't bloody joking, were you? So right then and there, I was in the team. And very proudly, in St. George's Day, so April the 23rd, I know my patron saints. the following year, I was
don't
the
test
first,
me. Jeez.
Yeah, I was the first one of the team of 11 to sort of break the £50,000. And here we were, you know, some business owners and high net worth individuals were also in the team. And little old me, who played dress up day to day, I'd done it through, you know, baking sausage rolls and at Borough Market and putting a stand in Borough Market, and I raised £1,500 just by baking sausage rolls. Companies had sort of put, you know, wanted to put their banner on my blog and sort of proud to support me, and I'd write a training blog. So the blog had also paid off, and then I leveraged, you know, writing some recipes for some big businesses in exchange for a very tax-efficient charity bid donation. So nice. I'd learned to leverage whatever I had. Every little bit, I wrung that towel dry.
Yeah, dust that lemon drizzle cake recipe down as well. We'll get that back out.
There's a lot of 20 pence plus inflation. I think that, you know, there will be a lot of pound lemon drizzles, you know, to be selling. But yeah. I would have done it as well. I would have done it. Honestly, I'd have kept baking. But it was life-changing. It was life-changing to sort of go and ride the route. It really was amazing for me. And I finished that year raising £63,000.
Wow.
Yeah.
Nice.
Look at your leukemia. Yeah.
Yeah. And do you know what? And this is again, you could, again, just kind of, this sounds really flippant for me to say, and I really don't mean this in that way, but you're following your energy. Like, these are things that are important to you. And, you know, cycling is obviously something that has played a big part in your life. You know, to have the opportunity to do something like that, sometimes these things present themselves. And you've just got to fast forward. This is the thing that I do now as I'm in my mid-40s. I fast forward my life if an opportunity presents itself. And I just asked myself, if in 20 years I look back on this, and would I regret not doing it? And more often than not, the answer is yes. So then I just go, well, sort it then. I'm going to do it. I'll figure out everything else. I'm just going to do this thing and see what happens. And it's kind of, it feels like you've kind of almost, you're following that kind of energy because these are things that are important to you.
Absolutely. I think the phrase is say yes to every opportunity. And I try and encourage our two daughters, now 20 and 17. And I suppose the ultimate say yes to every opportunity is, three of my teammates from 2015 that took on the tour, I got wind of, they were in control of their own diaries. They weren't employed. They were going to take on all three Grand Tours. So that's the Giro d'Italia, yeah, which is the Tour of Italy, the Tour de France, which you'd done in 2015, and the Vuelta a España, which is the Tour of Spain. Although the Tour de France is the most famous, arguably, there are no easy stages, but arguably, probably the Tour is the easier of the three Grand Tours.
Is that right?
Three Grand Tours.
Because it's so easy.
Yeah. Now, I got wind of this and said to the lads, it was Jeff, Doug and James, I said, there's no way you can do this without me, is it, flippantly. I'm the cyclist out of you lot, you know what I mean? You know, it was my dream to be a pro, blah, 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 you know. 2016 left this huge, horrible void of, you know, looking back and I wish it was this time last year and these were the stages and watching it on TV and dreaming of sort of riding one day before the pros. And I said, well, you know, we're raising substantial funds again. And I said, well, I was one of the best fundraisers in 2015, so I'll come up with strategy again. So I come up with this idea, which was a travel log would follow our journey. There were beautiful pictures and images of the scenery and four blokes suffering on a bike, mammals, middle-aged men in Lycra, for those of you who don't know.
Yeah. Oh, God, that's going to stick.
And would have a domestic-facing recipe following the terroir. So whether it was, you know, gnocchi in northern Italy, you know, a polenta dish, a tiramisu because you're in Veneto in Italy, or whether you ate it on the day or whether it was from that terroir. So that was the idea. What did I do? Rung Big Al. Alistair, I've got an idea. He was like, Big Al is an industry legend. I'm sure everyone who listens
without
to
question. Bill,
yeah. But he was a very, you know, without him, then a lot of this story wouldn't be told. So again, Big Al, extremely thankful. Well, even though we don't work together anymore, I never forget to wish him a Merry Christmas and his birthday. So I told him this idea. It will be this, it'll be that. I don't want no fancy recipe book that's going to take four pages. And I said, no, Alistair, let me just, you know, it'll be like I do at Borough Market, the recipes, it will be domestic facing. Apart from wild boar rigatoni from Umbria, which you could do the pork shoulder with, everything you can buy in a great supermarket. And he goes, I bloody love the idea. He never asked me how much. He never said to me how long I would need off work. But we agreed that, you know, I would go and get some quotes. I said that we would gift 1,000 of the copies of the book to our clients. Here's one of our lads, one of our employees that sort of beyond working at the stove and beyond being an employee was gone off and done this. That's 1,000 copies. The rest of the copies we would gift to the charity with 100% of the book sale in aid of the charity. I like to say, but it isn't really, but we bend the truth slightly, I finished at Goldman Sachs on March the 31st. April 1st, what do? Google, how do you write a book? It wasn't April the 1st because I'd done some pre-planning, but the Giro started on May the 4th, Star Wars Day. So I only really had 5 weeks of real hard yards, writing recipes, sort of doing a little bit of sort of investigation where the Giro route would go, what were the kind of dishes, you know, what were the kind of items, you know, the book sort of wrote itself really. Had to sort of do some of the photo shoots before I went out to the Giro in May, and bloody hell, that was a hard Giro. It was the centenary edition, started three stages in Sardinia, two in Sicily, then the length and breadth of Italy, up Mount Etna in Sicily, up Mount Stelvio twice. My goodness me. But no matter how hard it was on the bike, it was a lot harder writing that book.
Right.
Rode all three Grand Tours, finished the book on October the 16th. As I like to say, as I imagine it, in the book factory, someone pushes a big red button, October the 16th, the book gets printed, comes out just before Christmas, as previously agreed. So obviously it goes out to the Back to Story clients, they can have it as their Christmas gift. I think a lot of the business directors weren't happy with it being 1.8 kilos worth of book that they had to carry around and give it to the clients. But it was, 350 pages of storytelling and recipes and beautiful pictures. But again, the story didn't end there. The following year, it won 2 World Gourmand Awards. So here I am, that failed English student, now is an author.
Award-winning author. I love stories like this. I really, really love stories. I can't get enough of stories like this, to be honest, because there's also this element of, if you go back to school, I'm not saying go back to school. If you go back to your school years, there's probably a, correct me if I'm wrong, because this is part of my journey as well. I was never the most academically gifted guy. I probably could have been better. I just didn't have an application as a teenager at all. I was very, lateral thinking, let's put it that way, not a lot of focus thinking. But in that process, I remember being almost made to feel that I was destined for failure because you couldn't knuckle down, you couldn't focus and all of that kind of stuff. And there's still things that I still struggle to focus on today, but that'll come back to the energy thing. Here's your story for me is, like, you're in a similar situation whereby, the school environment is just not your place. So
I absolutely hated it. I was bullied at school. I couldn't wait to sort of get home. I'd sort of run home from school with your books. It was about a mile and a half. So that was probably your first interval training, should we say, running home from school. Probably with in my head, I had about the whole, 20 lads chasing me, but it wasn't like that. But that's how it felt in your head, metaphorically speaking.
And then, I think as well, I think about my journey in terms of being made to feel quite small. And, I also now know that being made to feel is a story that you tell yourself. You have way more capability within yourself than anyone can ever tell you. You can only tell that to yourself. So, I definitely changed my mindset towards that over the years. But there's also that I got told so many times, you'll never do this. You'll never be able to do this. You'll never be able to do this. And doing a lot of the things that they said I would never be able to do. You're now an award-winning author on the back of, failing English.
Yeah, I can't believe it,
But because with enough will and enough, finding the space that drives you and finding the thing that really ignites you, everything is possible. There's a way to find it. You might not be able to find every single word that you need, but you can find a way to find the words that you need. And, and that's a way more important message, I think, it really equates back to the kitchen again,
The disciplines of mise en place, of prep, of getting ready, the disciplines of, like you say, training, laying your clothes out in the night before. So, you'd have to go training because if not, you'd stumble over them, that kind of sort of approach. And like you say, those that say that you can't are probably scared that you can. And that you do.
Yeah.
They're the ones that probably are the ones that,
Yeah.
Is their own limitations, not your own. Yeah.
Yeah. No, indeed. Man, I could talk to you all day. We can't do that.
I'm sorry if we're certainly going to bore our future listeners.
Not at all.
Including Big Al, if he ever listens.
I'm having a great time. So,
so am I, actually, in truth. Yeah.
Yeah. Your journey is amazing. We haven't finished it yet either. So you alluded to it earlier on that, you were made redundant in 2020 from a company which it sounds like you still have a massive amount of respect for and the like.
Yes. I mean, look, I knew, well, I hope, unless someone's going to drop me a WhatsApp and tell me I've got it all wrong after listening to this, I knew I hadn't done anything wrong. It was numbers, the pandemic. It was horrific. No one knew. And I was just a number. And because I wasn't attributed to a single piece of business, I was a head office cost. I was, an exec chef that was doing strategy and projects. Even more, I was at risk, and they held on as long as they probably could. And I'll never forget, sort of a week after, I get a phone call from Big Al saying he just heard the news that I'd sort of been made redundant. Was there sort of anything that you know, am I all right? Is anything that, you know, for want of a better word, anything that I can do is in him.
Yeah.
And I said, look, of course not. I said, I'm just one of the statistics. And I said, and actually I'm very humbled by the fact that you, it's a Friday night. I could tell that he was in the car. He'd chosen to call. Certainly didn't need to. I'm just employee number X, Y, and Z. And I said to him sincerely that without him, my life wouldn't have gone on in the crossroads that it had. Without that conversation that we had in October, you know, 2014, I'd never have been able to ride the tour. I would have never have sort of had the audacity to sort of go and ride all three grand tours, to sort of pitch a book. And yes, I know that the CSR around it, and we got 6 pages in the caterer as a byproduct of sort of the rioting and all of the column inches, the CSR was huge, and the PR that we got out of it was a byproduct of riding the three grand tours and writing a book. But without, you know, Big Al's foresight in allowing me to do that, I'd have never have changed my life. And there's those stepping stones that are Lloyd's of London, taking that role, being offered that role, the perseverance of when it got difficult, just keep going, believe in yourself. The journey of National Chef of the Year, you know, 4 times, not giving up, just being the best version of yourself and cooking from the heart, and allowing that sort of, I suppose, mini notoriety to allow you then to deviate and then go on and be a fundraiser. And I've raised over £250,000 for Cure Leukemia now. And to be a patron of that charity, I'm extremely proud of. Anyone can ride a bike. Anyone can cook, as we know from Ratatouille. But to go and extract meaningful amounts of money from people's wallets and people's budgets and do it in a life-changing fashion for people that are suffering with leukemia, and now be a patron alongside Jeff Thomas, alongside Gary Lineker, and have your name on the footer of that, you know, that printed Cure Leukemia paper, I'm very, very proud. You know what I mean?
Yeah.
Very proud.
As you should be. As you should be. Not bad for an English failure, as it were.
Not bad for an English failure and a guy that worked the grill in McDonald's. You know?
Yeah. That's great. Really, really great. So talk to us. We probably need to wrap up soon.
We certainly should. Yeah.
But talk to us about what you're doing now then in terms of that was a catalyst to, you know, the 2020 situation was the catalyst to, you know, you effectively making the leap, I guess. It's always a leap of faith to back yourself.
Yeah, it's the ultimate backing yourself is what do you do on a rainy Thursday in the second week of January when there is no work and you've got bills to pay? You know, what is your strategy now? Yeah, it's all very well back in the day when you used to tweet the best version of yourself and your highlights reel and all of that nonsense. But actually, what does it really feel like to be chasing work? And it is scary. And without the pandemic, I'd probably still have, unless, again, someone's going to WhatsApp and tell me otherwise, I still would have probably a good job and 6 months worth of sick that I never used, or, you know, Bupa medical cover for you and your family and all of the niceties and the 5 weeks paid holiday. And now you submit an invoice. If your work isn't good enough, you don't get paid. If you don't work, you don't get paid. You have to put into your own pension, all of those other bits. Oh, you need a new computer. Well, that comes out of your budget. That comes out of your family finances. You know, can't get signal, can't do this, can't do that, need a new parachute. Whatever it is, you weigh it up. But everything that I'd done up until that point, every business that I worked at, I always treated money like it was my own. What was the best price? How could I offer the best value to my clients, whether it's your own intellectual property or it's working hard? And I've done anything from being in Harrods, helping, you know, operate a deep clean, going around during lockdown, actually, going around and helping mobilise nuclear power stations around the perimeter of the UK and Scotland. I've worked for represented businesses. I represent entertainment companies. Diary is at one point where, and I don't want to tempt fate, where I've actually had to turn down work or actually recruit someone to sort of assist me, sort of on subcontracting. So I'm not saying it will always be like that, but net net from that scary Thursday in January to now, it's been okay.
Yeah.
And I wouldn't, you know, from the guy that was I think I told you just in a conversation we'd had, you know, a couple of weeks back, that I was on the roof of the house scraping moss off, tied to the chimney breast with a couple of heavy duty bungees and a leather belt, listening to a podcast when the phone rang, and it was Andrew Fishwick on behalf of another client saying, can you get to Ealing? We've got a job, if you'd like that job, to open a restaurant in about 10 days time. We haven't got any staff, we haven't got any suppliers. Can you turn up and have a look? Go. There was an oven that hadn't been cleaned, even though it was a self-cleaning oven, and there was two Lemsip sachets on the windowsill. Huh. And apart from that, there was nothing there in the kitchen. What do? You roll up your sleeves. Actually, I called upon my mate, my long-suffering sous chef, that he was still working but was during lockdown, the one that I was his best man. Fancy a couple of hours work, we'll get down and dirty cleaning. Got a KP that I'd worked with. We stripped that kitchen, we got it clean. Then he told me about, I think such and such lives near here. Why don't we give him a call? He calls, he's looking for some work. He looks in, suddenly we've got a number two. Then we rung some local suppliers. Then we needed to order some crockery, some cutlery. Then we get a mini team together and we open on schedule. Yeah, it was a challenge.
For sure.
And then, God forbid, then we went back into lockdown just before Christmas again.
You've done all that work.
Yeah, I've been tested. I've been stretched. I've done rewarding work. I've done some stuff that I probably would not put on my CV, but I've done it and we've achieved it and we've made it happen. And, yeah, here we are talking. What are we, 2 weeks before Christmas to yourself and rambling on about?
Ramble away. No, but in all seriousness, we probably should wrap this up. But
yeah, we definitely should. Yeah.
Look, Hayden, I'm so grateful to you for reaching out to me around, you know, what was effectively really heartfelt support for Kira. Really, I mean, and her achievements in the Young National Chef this year. And this is the joy of me, and you kind of just alluded to it there in that last little story of opening a restaurant in 10 days as well. This is one of the big joys of this industry for me, is the network in which you create. And you actually don't even need to try that hard to create it. Mm. It's just, there's so many people with goodwill in this industry of ours. There's so many people who are willing to give their time. You've just mentioned Big Al, and kudos to you for calling him Big Al, by the way. I think that is the first time I've ever heard anybody call Alistair Story that.
I do, but it's tongue-in-cheek and in a sense of endearment.
But heartfelt,
Heartfelt and very proudly, because our eldest, Kira, another Kira, Kira Groves, not Kira O'Connellan, she is doing a degree apprenticeship with WSH.
Fantastic.
And so she works 4 days a week for Circe's and one day, she's in her second year now. She was also working at Guards Polo events, and Big Al was there, but she would never dare call him that, and rightly so.
Yeah, not yet, not yet. She's got Aaron Art right.
And I messaged to Alistair and said, Alistair, I understand you're there. My daughter would absolutely love to meet you if there's an opportunity. She knows I held you in absolute high esteem, and it would be lovely to, you know, she's one of your degree apprentices. And woe and behold, the mark of the man, he left the dinner table probably straight after dessert and went to whoever was running the function, said, can I meet Kira Groves? And he went up and met her, spent some time with her, had a nice brief conversation and a photo for Kira's LinkedIn. And that's the mark of the man. He understands that you're only as good as the staff and the people around you. And he inspired me, and he allowed me the opportunity to inspire others in and out the kitchen.
Yeah. And these moments have big impact, you know, in terms of what they can do to inspire and just help people move forward, for sure. But no, look, as I say, I'm so grateful to you for reaching out. This has been a really fantastic conversation. I think so many lessons which I will have to decompress on until I really truly understand, because there's just so many great things in your journey so far. Still got a lot to do, I'm sure. And also, you know, given the fact that you were talking about the fact that you were 39 around 2013, so that means you must now be into your 50s.
51, yeah.
Yeah, yeah. So yeah. You're a cracking advert for cycling as a means to stay young.
I think we'll leave it on this bombshell that cycling's given me a hell of a lot, but it's also robbed me of a front tooth through an accident.
So, right.
I think those of you who follow me on Instagram will know the stories and the ramblings. If you don't, then at Hayden K. Groves. Hopefully, when they do look me up, I'll have my implant finished, which is due for January. But my goodness me, price of a small car and the pain involved. It's like, I don't urge anyone. Stop with brakes rather than your face.
That's the
takeaway message.
Maybe the most important message of the day.
Message, yeah. The only message that counts, yeah.
Indeed. Hayden, thank you so much. An absolute pleasure to spend some time with you, and wish you all the very best with the next chapter.
Likewise, Phil. Thank you for your time.
No worries. Take care. Well, that was an absolute treat. Hayden's energy, honesty and resilience make his story impossible not to be inspired by. From cycling discipline to kitchen pressure and that infamous grouse moment, he's proof that setbacks really can set you up for something bigger. A huge thanks to Hayden for sharing so openly. We'll be back soon with another brilliant conversation, so until then, take care, stay resilient, have yourselves a fantastic festive period, and we'll catch you next time.